Welcome, people of Earth, to yet another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm Bernard Meisler, your host and the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. We have a great guest tonight, Shavisa Woods, who is a fiction author. Does that make sense? Author of fiction, writer of fiction, fiction writer, and she's also a poet. Her first collection was called Love Does Not Make Me Gentle or Kind, followed up by the Albino album in 2013, and her most recent collection was Things to Do When You're Goth in the Country, which came out in 2017. And she's got a new collection of Me Too movement pieces, so to speak, coming out shortly. And we had a good conversation. I'm quite a bit older than Shavisa. We're of a different generation, yet we had the same mentor, interestingly enough, Mr. John Ferris. And Shavisa actually reads a terrific poem by John called White Paper at around the 35-minute mark. Do not miss it. And towards the end of the conversation, she will read an excerpt from a, as of yet, unpublished story, but probably not unpublished for too long, called Exit Stage. It's terrific, just like Shavisa. And it's funny, we found out we had quite a bit of things in common. We start out talking about the Me Too movement, and then she gets into her background growing up as a goth in the country in rural Illinois. And then it turns out that we have the same favorite episode of Mystery Science Theater 3000, Manos, the Hands of Fate. It's true. All right, here's Shavisa Woods. All right, so the guest today is Shavisa Woods, author of, let me see if I get the title right, 100 Things to Do When You're Goth in the Country. Is that it?
You're actually conflating two different books.
Oh, man.
So it's okay. There's Things to Do When You're Goth in the Country, which is like my most recent book of fiction.
Right. Okay.
That came out in 2017. And then I have another book that's coming out in 2019 called 100 Times,
a memoir
of sexism.
Yeah. That's right. Oh, yeah, and that's you were originally posting that as like little vignettes on Facebook, if I remember.
Yeah, so it's 100 experiences of sexual harassment, discrimination, and assault I've experienced throughout my life. And I originally posted some of them as Facebook posts.
Okay.
Like,
And how did you pare it down to just 100?
That's interesting. Most people ask me how I came up with a whole 100 things, but how did I pare it down to just 100?
Yeah.
A sad and funny question at the same time. I think I chose the most formative experiences of sexism in my life. Mm-hmm. These are literally 100 things that sort of rush through my mind when people are talking about sexism, or usually men question how it's really impacted me.
Mm-hmm.
So these are things that I remember from the age of 5 to now, where it's like these were blatant, almost inarguable instances of sexism that really shaped me as a person.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of interesting that how everybody's perceptions of these of this has changed, even dramatically so more recently. I don't know. I'll try to think of an example. You look at like just about any movie or TV show from the 80s. And
yeah,
there's just so much blatant wrong stuff going on, and it's kind of constant. And I think it's good that people are maybe getting a little bit more awareness of this. People, you know, my age, obviously people your age are a lot more on top of things like this.
I think it's becoming more visible to everyone. I think it's been invisible to men for a long time, as well as to some women. I know that some of the men who read my posts on Facebook actually messaged me saying that it brought them closer to their female partners, which was sort of unexpected for me, but I'm really happy to hear it. I think by the time I got to number 60, one man told me that he had shared it with his girlfriend, and he said, can you believe that one woman has experienced this many instances of sexual assault and harassment and discrimination? And she said to him very pointedly, yes.
Yeah.
And then he realized that a lot of what happened to her didn't happen to her when he was around, so it was invisible to him.
Right. I mean, as a, you know, as a man, I suppose I am by definition an asshole about this kind of stuff, but I'll be honest, it's just like the kind of conversations that used to go on that I don't think that people are a little more circumspect about these days. You know, the things I've heard and things I've seen. I understand, and I also say I have two daughters who are 18 and 21, and I just, you know, I see what they go through, you know, and I just know that's why I said it's like only 100, because I imagine this probably happens like to most women every time they leave the house when they're going shopping. There's just, you know, if nothing else, is ogling going on.
There's a type of sexism that informs almost every sphere, if not probably every sphere of our lives. And it's not just sexual harassment. Some of what I wrote about in the book are instances of blatant discrimination. Some of them are comical. Mm-hmm. Even there was one where I was in my late 20s and I was managing an art project for an artist that I was actually partnered with, but who I'd worked with for many years. Itziar Barrio, and I had, you know, purchased or rented this large billboard from this billboard company, and it was very high up on a building and very susceptible to wind, and I had ordered this very tight mesh for this art billboard. It was an image to be printed on, and they gave me vinyl, and when they put it up, it immediately ripped, and I had paid more than $5,000 for this. As far as they knew, from my own money, but it's money that we had raised for the art project. And I went into the office and I told them, no, I ordered this other material. I researched this. It needs to be this tight mesh. And they kept saying, that won't work. It'll be see-through. But he knew at that height and distance, it wouldn't be. And they wouldn't listen to me. And he actually called me a little girl and told me to calm down and sit down. So I went outside, took my cell phone out and called a male friend of mine who knew nothing about the project. He's an English teacher and poet. He knows nothing about the construction of billboards or whatever. And mm-hmm. I just told him what to say. I had him write down these certain words. And then I went in and I told the manager of this company, who I had paid, that this man was my boss. And he wanted to talk to him because he was angry. And within a few minutes, when this male voice told him that he needed to do this thing, he agreed to it and apologized to me.
Yeah, of course.
And the guy, my friend, didn't even know what he was talking about. I mean, it was comical. He was just repeating my words exactly.
Yeah, and I hear stories like that all the time. I mean, very recently, a friend of mine told a story how she lost the key to her car somewhere. And it's one of those fancy, you know, newfangled keys, electronic keys or whatever. And she went to the dealer, and the dealer was, oh, yeah, that's $250. And she's like, $250? And she didn't have it, so she left. And she asked a male friend of hers to go there, and the guy's like, oh, yeah, it's $65.
Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is...
It's almost like, yeah. It, some of it reminds me of that Eddie Murphy skit from Saturday Night Live.
James Brown Celebrity Hot Tub?
No, it's where he actually does whiteface and goes into stores. And when there are no black people around, they don't make him pay for anything.
Mm.
It's this way that bigotry sort of undermines your basic humanity and inclusion in society.
Yeah.
I thought that was a brilliant skit.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so much of it on so many levels, you know, for people of color. And I following the news about my new political hero, who's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yes.
And it's so fucked up. They're like, you know, say they're talking about like the clothes she's wearing, you know, and making fun of her for not having enough money. And it's like what's being, you know, unsaid is like she should get a man to take care of her.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, Yeah.
Well, honestly, I mean, this is my first book of nonfiction and my fourth full-length book, and I didn't ever really want to write a memoir. I never really wanted to write nonfiction, but at this point, I'm a storyteller, mm-hmm. and I felt like just telling my life stories was the best way to address this issue that I felt like I had to say something about.
Yeah, no,
I prefer to stick to fiction, honestly.
Mm-hmm. I think it's great if you're going to write a memoir to have a singular purpose for it, if you know what I mean, a subject rather than like, here's my life story, because right. you know, there's just way too many memoirs out there, and most of them are really not that interesting.
I actually agree with that, unfortunately.
Yeah. I heard somebody say once, you know, man, if I read another book about somebody, you know, I never want to read another book about, you know, people's adventures with sexual and drug adventures, you know, unless it's Led Zeppelin.
Led Zeppelin. Yeah, I understand.
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually, with all the Me Too stuff going around, I'm still, it's kind of interesting that it hasn't affected the music world so much, because, oh my God, you know. Where's the scandals about, you know, speaking of Led Zeppelin, of Jimmy Page with his 13-year-old girlfriends and getting them hooked on heroin and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting who gets called out for this. And I also, when I wrote 100 Times, A Memoir of Sexism, I don't actually name any of the men in the book. Mm-hmm. I found the sort of going after celebrities to be, well, you know, in some cases it was very necessary. It also, only doing that is very sensational, and it doesn't really address the root of the problem for most women. Most okay. women aren't getting harassed by like celebrities or right. producers.
Or Kevin Spacey or whatever. Yeah.
They're just getting, you know, dehumanized
right,
by systemic sexism.
Right. It's their manager at the meatpacking plant or whatever. Yeah. Who's not going to make the news, I guess, because people don't find that interesting. But I don't know. I think just in the culture that we live in, perhaps the fact that it is, you know, focusing on movie stars and media personalities does have a way of seeping, you know, out to the rest of society. I hope so, at least.
No, I think it was an important first step, but I do think we have to expand the conversation. And that's sort of what I'm trying to do.
Okay, so let me ask you. Let's go back a little bit. I want you to tell me a little bit more about yourself. Where did you grow up?
Right. So I grew up in a small farm town of just over 1,000 people in southern Illinois, about an hour and a half southeast of East St. Louis.
Uh huh. And southern Illinois is, if I'm guessing, not so much different from Kentucky, maybe, or the Pennsyltuckyho, we used to call it.
I think it would be more similar to Indiana, southern Missouri, okay. Kansas City.
Okay.
Those are all sort of the same place mm-hmm. in my mind. Right. Northern Illinois is actually very different. Southern Illinois.
Right. I guess that's what I was trying to
say. Technically, like below the Mason-Dixon line, even though all of Illinois was part of the North. But Missouri is, you know, the same. Like lateral distance to southern Illinois, and it's southern. So there are like Confederate flags and just it's really Trump country.
Right.
And that's sort of where my book Things to Do When You're Goth in the Country, which just came out last year, is mm-hmm. primarily set.
And one of the stories in that, I believe, was in Sensitive Skin a few years ago about the UFOs.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
It was. How to Stop Smoking in 19,287 Seconds, Usama.
Yes, what a great piece that was, too.
You published that with that title. Thank you.
Yeah. It's a great title, too. But yeah, I guess that's what I was getting at in my ham-handed way, is that people hear Illinois and they think Chicago, but, you know, but yeah. Southern Illinois is the South, basically.
It is, yes. Yeah. It's very southern.
Yeah. And what was it like growing up there for someone with a artistic bent, or maybe who didn't, you know, fit in so well?
Well, yeah, I was always an artist. There are things about it that I still love. And I just got back from visiting for Thanksgiving just a few days ago, actually. Mm-hmm. So I still have many friends there. There was a community theater there that I really enjoyed. And when you're weird in Southern Illinois, you really have to find the other weirdos immediately. So I had a little group from around the county.
Okay.
And those people are still very dear to me. And I, you know, I'm from the country. I like some of the vibe. I like that everything's not totally politically correct and people can get in an argument and still be friends after. Mm-hmm. Sometimes even a physical fight and still be friends after. I like the cheap drinks and I like all the stars and I like to, you know, hop on a motorcycle with a stranger and drive to a bar out in the middle of the country. So there are things about it I like. But it was really difficult being a kid there. I still have nightmares about it. People threatened to kill me. There was an active KKK in the town. I was, you know, harassed and sometimes beaten up a lot in school just because I guess I was kind of, I mean, I was a strange person, still am a strange person. I was queer and a witch and an artist and a vegetarian in a place where like no one else really was that.
Yeah, the vegetarian especially is probably.
They actually, I think starting in junior high when I first became a vegetarian, like I found dead animals in my desk, you know, because that's what they did to, they would like kill squirrels and stuff and put them in my desk. And some boys held me down and killed like grasshoppers on me, like on my face when I was like 13 years old. It was, they just really didn't take kindly to people who didn't eat meat over there. Mm-hmm. But it's a lot of material.
Grist for the mill.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so when you got out of high school, did you get out immediately or as soon as you could? Or did you stick around or did you go to college?
Well, I moved away to St. Louis actually like within a month, I think, of graduating high school. Mm-hmm. And St. Louis is a really small city. I think it has a population of about 300,000. But people in Southern Illinois looked at it as the jungle or like the biggest city they could imagine. And when I was talking about moving to St. Louis when I was 18, just a few months before graduating, I was actually working at a mental institution or, you know, an insane asylum in Southern Illinois when I was 18. That was my like high school gig. Uh-huh. it paid better than any other place, like any fast food restaurant.
Did you meet any interesting people while you were there?
Yeah, I did. It was actually a place mostly for people who were adults with IQs, with low IQs or developmentally delayed, different issues. A lot of them had the IQ maybe of like 12 years old or under. So I really loved them and I felt really connected to them. But I also, the facility itself was pretty horrific and dirty and they didn't get the best care. And I was one of like three activities specialists. I was supposed to sort of enhance their daily lives, which was difficult to do sometimes just because they were sort of living in squalor and I was only there 3 days a week and there were so many of them, but I did want to make their lives more pleasurable and better. I think the most horrific thing I saw though was there was a man there with cerebral palsy and we all agreed that he really shouldn't have been there because you may know that people with cerebral palsy don't have any developmental, cognitive developmental issues. And he was always just sort of screaming and that was pretty dark because he was surrounded by people who were just not at his cognitive level, but he couldn't move. So he was being treated very differently cognitively than he should have been. And that was a pretty hellish, that's just a hellish memory for me. And to know that he was just left there. And even though we complained to the administration, like his family had him there and there was nothing we could do.
Yikes.
Yeah, I have a lot of dark stories and they often find their way into my writing.
Yeah, that's some. I sometimes feel that way about just living on this planet, though, you know, I want to wake up screaming sometimes. So you moved to St. Louis and were you already writing by this time? You said you were an artist from the time you were a little kid. Was writing always your thing or were you doing other stuff as well?
I was also acting. I was in some Shakespeare and Company plays in St. Louis, and I had been part of the theater in Southern Illinois, the community theater there, the Centralia Cultural Society. But I was writing since I was seven, and I was writing mostly poetry and short stories. And I decided I wanted to be a writer when I was 7 years old. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I moved to St. Louis and I started doing Poetry Slam for a couple years from about 18 to 21. I even made the St. Louis Slam team a couple years in a row. Mm-hmm. Was pretty cool, and I was living in an anarchist collective called Camp in St. Louis, Community Arts and Media Project. So I became an activist in St. Louis pretty seriously, got into like political activism, and was doing a lot of art projects with some of the other artists in St. Louis and doing Poetry Slam.
Cool. And then you move, and then how did you end up moving to New York?
I moved to New York when I was 21 years old. Because I knew someone who knew Steve Cannon at a gathering of the tribes. And I know you know Steve.
Yes, Steve and I go way back.
And I actually lived at tribes with him from like 21 to 23. Uh-huh. So almost 3 years I lived in tribes.
Oh.
For people who don't know, tribes was like a very weird multicultural art space. It was thought an artist salon, an art gallery, and a small press. And the man who runs this art gallery is blind and a retired professor who's now in his early 80s. And I was sort of his personal assistant and his eyes and an editor on the magazine, Tribes Magazine, which is a literary and arts magazine.
Which issue did you start working on?
I was just an assistant editor. I think I was an assistant. Well, I actually worked there for 3 years. So I was an assistant editor on 10, 11, and 12. And also just but I wasn't one of the main editors with my name on the magazine. I was in the office reading the submissions every week and coordinating events for tribes and fundraising for the magazine.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the other great part about tribes, of course, was the stoop. That's where the real action was.
I got there right after the stoop, unfortunately.
Okay.
But we did I did coordinate the Charlie Parker Festival every year for almost 8 years. Steve tasked me with all of the coordination of the Charlie Parker Festival. And we had the Hungry March Band in and Billy Bang in. And then mm-hmm. all of the downtown poets did the big reading once a year. That was really beautiful.
Uh-huh. And I'll mention this, too, is like, so I've known Steve so long that I knew him before he was blind. How about that?
Wow.
Yeah. And
what was he like then?
He was, well, you know, obviously more outgoing. He was out on the town all the time, you know, he was,
right.
you know, hanging out at Vazak's with the gang. But of course, for the longest time, the thing to do is, I don't know what's going on. Not doing anything to, I guess I'll just go hang out at the stoop, see who's hanging on the stoop. Yeah. And there was always some people hanging there, but.
And the stoop was the writing workshop that happened at a gathering of the tribes once a week.
Okay. Is that what they named it? Okay. Because I was thinking the stoop was just like the stairs in front of Steve's house.
Oh. I think that's just tribes. Yeah.
On East 3rd Street between C and D, which was probably at that time the hairiest block in the East Village. And it was just starting to maybe get a little less crazy. And across the street was the Living Theater, and I was hanging out with, and John Ferris was living in the basement of the Living Theater.
Yeah.
So we were just like hanging out there all the time, and down the street was New Yorican. But yeah, it's funny. It's just like Steve originally, now my memory is like not crystal clear from those days for many reasons, but Steve originally wanted me and Norman to start the magazine. And instead we separately and then together ended up in Paris, and we came back and we started Sensitive Skin. And Steve's in the first issue. The first issue is like me, Norman, Steve, Darius, James. I might be forgetting one or two people, and Ferris, of course. And then Steve was, and that's what finally like compelled or impelled Steve to like, if these guys can do it, I got to start doing this magazine. So
Steve has told me that story exactly the same way many times. So it's glad to hear you corroborate the events.
Yeah.
And for people who are listening who don't know, John Ferris was a radical leftist poet and fiction author, and in his later years also became a visual artist, I believe.
Yeah.
Who Bernard and I both know, and who passed away a few years ago,
yeah,
unfortunately, but who lived in a squat on Third Street most of his life.
Yeah. And John was our mentor, you know, when I was first living in the East Village and starting to get into the writing scene, and we discovered Neither Nor, and John was hanging around there, and he was he took us all under his wing, me and Norman and Emily Carter and Darius, and you know, Darius was already more established than any of us, but John was great, and he had so many stories. I remember one time he took us, there's me, Norman, and a couple other people, and Sun Ra was playing at the Blue Note. And he's like, come on, let's go see Sun Ra. And we're like, yeah, okay. And so we went over there, and he's telling us, yeah, you know, I know all these guys, and I'm friends with Ornette Coleman. And we're like, yeah, okay. Another,
yeah. But it's true.
Yeah, but it's true. And then we go to the show, and after the show, the whole band comes over to our table. And it's like, Ferris, where you been, man? He's like, oh, you know. And it's like, come on, hang out with us. We're going to party. And he's like, nah, I'm going to hang out with these guys. And it was like one of the great moments of my life. That he wanted to hang out with us instead of Sun Ra.
Wow. I think you're probably, are you talking about the 90s? Is that when this was occurring?
This was probably like 86 or something like that, 87.
So it's pretty amazing to me because I moved to into Tribes and into New York in 2003, and John Ferris did the same thing with me.
Uh-huh.
And I guess he didn't like everybody, but now we're all part of this group. He immediately started reading my poetry and telling me what was wrong with it in no uncertain terms.
Mm-hmm.
He took me to New Blue often, which is a pretty famous jazz club that's on Avenue C down there. And he would always, I didn't have any money. I was just living at Tribes for free in, you know, I was getting free rent in exchange for work. And so he would put everything we ate or drank on his tab. And I later found out that he just had unlimited free whatever he wanted at New Blue Cafe.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I was going to say
Ferris's tab. Which they had eventually given him for being a regular.
Mm-hmm.
But that was really another world because they did respect artists and writers that way. And a writer being broke or poor was handled very differently. And I'm even talking about the early aughts down there, like giving him anything he wanted for free because he wrote about jazz and they were a jazz club is sort of unheard of now.
That's sad.
It was a whole other world. And I'm so glad that I got to be part of it. And I wish it wasn't just the end of it that I got to be part of.
Yeah. I mean, I guess New York has changed a lot that way, or the whole world has, actually. But I think there was also less of a line of demarcation between quote unquote successful artists and artists just doing their thing. You know what I mean?
I completely agree with that.
Yeah.
If you were an artist, you were an artist.
Right. And it wasn't just like, oh, you're not famous, so you can't hang around with us or whatever. Which is,
you don't have an agent. Where have you published?
Yeah.
Where have you shown? It was, you know, good if you had that, but you were still respected.
Right. Right.
Even if you didn't, if people liked your art, that's how they judged it. So it is shifting. It's becoming much more capitalist in New York lately.
Yeah. Everything's becoming. Well, I think this is a whole nother rabbit hole we can go down, but I don't think that the problem is even capitalism, because I don't think what we have now is capitalism. I think you could call it late stage capitalism in Marxist terms, but I think we've gone beyond capitalism, where we're just into an oligarchy, which is, you know, even worse. But at any rate, yeah, everything's gotten commodified, and I don't know. But one other thing I wanted to mention about Ferris is, like, he had so many stories he would tell us, and I found out, you know, at some point they were all true. And did you know that he was Malcolm X's bodyguard?
And, I did know that.
Yeah, was on stage when he was assassinated, and. Yeah, and was...
Yeah, a lot of those guys are in the Lower East Side, Keith Roach, I think, who I got to come in contact with and who would critique my writing, I later learned were Black Panthers. And I didn't know that after, you know, until being there for about a year. And then I heard a lot of crazy stories about people housing guys who were running from the cops with machine guns in the 60s and 70s. And I didn't realize that I was hanging out with a bunch of old Black Panthers until it suddenly dawned on me that that's what was going on.
Yeah.
It was very cool.
It was very cool. I remember, some of the people, I shan't name names, but I was like, oh, he's a murderer. Interesting. He's like, this guy's like kind of crazy. He's, yeah, but I like you, man. It's cool. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, good. I remember one time back in the 80s, I was hanging out at Neither Nor, and these, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and these three tough kids approached me and just wanted to like give me a hard time. And Ferris walked up and said, fuck you guys, leave him alone. And one of these kids hauled off and punched him square in the face. And Ferris didn't fucking blink. He just like stared at him, and the kids like looked at each other and ran out the door.
This is so strange because we have the same stories about John Ferris. I was at Tribes at an art opening, and I guess this must have been in like 2005 or 6. And there was a guy there who was wearing this giant crucifix. And if you know John Ferris and his writing, you know, he really doesn't like Christianity very much at all. Mm-hmm. And he leans over to this guy who's just at the gallery show and looks kind of like a guy I wouldn't really mess with. He's a big guy, probably in his mid-30s, looks a little rough. And John Ferris, and he, you know, he's a rough white guy. And John Ferris is, for those of you who don't know, he's Black. And he's, at this point, he was probably in his mid to late 70s. He was pretty frail because this is much later. Mm-hmm. Than he had a cane. And he leans over to this man and he says, young man, why are you wearing that obscene instrument of torture? And the guy punched him in the face.
Wow.
And then John Ferris started to fall over. I was actually standing next to him, and me and a couple people grabbed him, and the kid starts to jump over the table that's between them. And this guy was big and he was just going to kick the shit out of him. And I stepped in between him and I actually said to him, like, you want to hit him, you're going to have to hit a girl first. And the guy, like, you know, got talked down and got escorted out of the gallery. And John Ferris, then, you know, after that, was even nicer to me than he had been before. He was an old man at that point.
Yeah.
But he did not hold back on what he thought at all. And I'm sure it's not the only two times he's been punched in the face in his life.
Hardly, I'm sure. Yeah.
That obscene instrument of torture.
Yeah. Okay. He had a way with words, that's for sure.
He sure did.
Yeah.
And his most famous poem is White Paper, which is just him protesting God. It's, God, I protest you. You know. Are you familiar with that poem?
I'm not. No, I'm not sure.
I'm trying to see if I can actually pull it up because I... Well, I have it somewhere. Maybe I'll send it to you and you can read it sometime. But I can find it. It is just him protesting God. And at one point he says, God, you were such a cunt. I mean, he's not
mincing words.
He's not mincing words.
Listen, if you send it to me, I'll publish it on the website. I'd love to not just see it for myself. I'd like other people to be able to see more of his work.
Yeah, that was my favorite piece by him, actually. I'm not too keen on the Christianity either.
Yeah, me neither. Which is, you know, I was talking with somebody the other day who's in Nashville, and it sort of came up, but I didn't get into it. But that's my problem with the South, you know. I remember my wife and I were in Atlanta. This must be 15, 20 years ago. And we went to the Waffle Hut for breakfast because Waffle House, right?
Waffle Hut.
Because it, Waffle Hut, whatever. Yeah, Waffle. No. Sorry, Waffle House. I don't mean to disrespect my Southern brothers and sisters by maligning their most cherished culinary institution. But, you know, that's what everybody says. Oh, you got to go to the Waffle House for breakfast. So go to the Waffle House. And it's, you know, it's like going, you know, to the Odessa or something like that. And right. we're sitting there having breakfast, and there's some guy sitting next to us. And then another man comes and sits next to him, and he says, excuse me, sir. Is anyone sitting here? You know, the guy says, no. And he says, have you been saved? And he says, yes.
Oh my God.
Yes, I have. Yeah. Have you? He says, of course. And they sit down, and then they started talking about like computers and processors and RAM and stuff like that. And I just thought it was the weirdest thing I'd ever seen.
Christians are so strange.
Yeah.
I actually, Bernard, I found it. I found the poem.
Ooh.
Because I've had it for years. Would you mind if I read the poem by John Ferris? It's not too long.
You know, I would love it if you would, but maybe hold on a couple more minutes. And because I'd like, would you like to read some of your own work as well?
Yeah, I would. I just thought this was on theme.
Oh, okay, go for it.
All right. I just love John. He's so much fun. And I think I was probably 21 or 22 when I first heard him read this. And, you know, I just kind of wanted to follow him around like a puppy from after this Aww. Poem. So this is White Paper by John Ferris. I protest. I protest you, God. God damn you. I protest your omnipresence. God, you are such a busybody. I protest you invented yourself. I protest the cryptic way you explain things. I protest your image of me as imperfect when I am created in your image. I protest my appetite for big oil. I protest dust. I protest teeth. I protest hair. I protest your holy relic. I protest weapons of mass destruction, no matter who has them, including you. I protest stone. I protest your pushing the earth up and down like a roller coaster, a shopping cart. Everywhere you go, you cause trouble. You wear blood like a coat. You wear bone like a hat. You have only worked 6 lousy days in your entire life, according to your own record. You are nowhere near omnipotent God. Come on, you are such a cunt. You have penile dysfunction. It is well known that the only sex you ever had was a myth.
That's awesome. Oh, that's wonderful.
You're welcome. John Ferris.
John Ferris. Oh, I miss him. But before we get on to hearing some of your work, I just wanted to ask you, what are you reading these days?
I was actually recently reading Men Explain Things to Me by Rebecca Solnit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also reading Frankenstein.
Oh, Frankenstein is great.
Yes. I'm skipping around a lot right now. I'm not quite sure why. Sometimes I find something and I get into it and I read a long book over the course of a month. But right now I'm reading a lot of different things. Even last night, I think some of my friends were over here, Joseph Keckler and Elizabeth Gimble, who are sort of part of a downtown art scene now. And that we were reading aloud to each other, and we read Shirley Jackson, and then I read them a story by David Foster Wallace. So I'm reading all sorts of things right now.
Hmm. I could never get into David Foster Wallace.
Really? I love him.
Yeah, I know a lot of people do. Did you see the recent movie that was that came out about him with Jason Segel playing David Foster Wallace?
I think I like him so much, and I heard so many bad things about that. It wasn't really...
Yeah,
I didn't watch it.
Yeah,
I was afraid to watch it.
Yeah, I watched it and I was kind of like, yeah, David Foster Wallace. I got to read some David Foster Wallace. And I looked up and I found his piece that he wrote about cruise ships. This is one of his first big publications. And I was reading it and I was like, okay, I get it. Cruise ships are dumb. You didn't need 25,000 words. Come on, man.
Oh, yeah. I've actually read that two or three times. I'm in love with that essay.
Okay.
So we very much disagree.
Yeah, I'm not. No, he was. I mean, he was great, but just, you know.
A lot of people don't like him. I really get into his language, and I find him so fun to read. I feel like my brain's like electrified when I read him. He's one of my favorites. One of my other favorites is, two of my other favorites, I'll name two, is Harry Cruz, who I love, Angela Carter, who we were also reading last night, and Richard Brodigan. I'm sure you like Richard Brodigan.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember.
But those are also people who make me feel sort of like all lit up when I read them.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot about the language, though. But David Foster Wallace, half of his essays are in the footnotes. Like, he'll have pages in the footnotes, which I really like. It's kind of dorky, but it seems fun to me.
It's funny because it's one of those what is it? Is it multiverse sort of thing? There's a term for this that's escaping me right now, but the idea that you know, people have the same ideas at the same time. Like, for instance, Isaac Newton and Leibniz, I think his name was, in Germany, discovered calculus at the same time.
Oh.
Even though they had zero contact with each other, and everybody's forgotten about Leibniz. But not to put myself in his caliber of writing by any means, but I was working on a novel back then, which, again, it was like there was a story, but the real story was all in the footnotes. I was writing, it was like two-thirds of it was footnotes. And then he came out with Infinite Jest. So I was like, oh, man.
That sucks when that happens. Yeah. Oh, man.
I think it might have just been because we probably discovered around the same time that the latest version of Microsoft Word allowed you to go crazy with footnotes like that. So that's what sort of made it possible. You could just, you know. But have you ever seen the movie Bride of Frankenstein?
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, the beginning.
Of course, Bernard.
The beginning of that movie is like the fucking goofiest thing I've ever seen in my life, right? Where it's like Mary Shelley and Percy, and who was their third guy, who was, you know, they're hanging around talking about the monster. Then what happened? And they're like there. In their like bad Hollywood version of like what, you know, the rich people look like in 1802 or whatever. It's hilarious. And of course that was also the basis for Young Frankenstein. It's just the whole plot is the same as Bride of Frankenstein.
Well, yeah. But Young Frankenstein is much better.
you should really watch the two of them back to back, though, right?
What makes you think I haven't? I've got a lot of uncles, and that was sort of like a thing that we would do when I was a little kid. My dad also really loved Mystery Science Theater.
Oh, yeah.
So
Mystery Science Theater was great back in the original series with Joel.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I just love that deadpan humor he had.
What's your favorite Mystery Science Theater?
It might be Manos, Hands of Fate.
See, that's mine.
Yeah.
That's my
favorite.
I love so Manos, the Hands of Fate is like the worst horror movie ever made. And I'm just telling the people listening, and the guy with the pillows for knees, Togar, is amazing. I mean, he's supposed to be a monster, but his only monstrous feature is they've just tied pillows into his pants where his knees are.
And that movie is just so, and there's a funny backstory about it too, about the guy who made it. I mean, it's kind of like he was like a minor league Ed Wood or something like that. You know, it's not quite up to the caliber of an Ed Wood movie.
No, it's not even as good as an Ed Wood movie. Yeah.
There's like, if I remember, there's like scenes where it's a couple and they've, you know, the classic story of a couple driving through the country, and they stumble across like the weird hotel or whatever. But I believe there's like a 5 or 6 minute segment that's just like the camera like looking through their windshield, and nothing is happening.
Nothing. You know? My favorite is like Togor's first line. It's all so heavy handed. And nonsensical somehow at the same time, because usually heavy-handed lines just tell you exactly what's happening in the dialogue in a really unnatural way.
Right.
But he says to them when they enter this haunted mansion, he says, "I am Togor. I take care of the house while the master is away. He's dead, but not in the way you know it."
Oh, you're making me want to watch it again.
Right now.
Yeah, I guess my other favorite one would be the Gamera one, where they sing the Gamera song.
I have not seen that one.
Oh my goodness, this Gamera is really neat. He is filled with turtle meat. We all love you, Gamera. That's
what's a Gamera?
Gamera is a Japanese monster.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a giant turtle. And he would have these jets that came out of his ass that made him fly into the air, and he could spin around, and couldn't really do much besides that. But that's another classic.
Yeah. I could do this all night.
Yeah. All right. Do you want to read us something?
Yeah. You asked for me to read something new. So I'm actually going to read something that I wrote a few months ago that hasn't been published yet. It's completely new to everyone.
All right.
No one will have ever heard this before. This is called Exit Stage, and I'm going to start in the middle. So basically, this is a teenage girl who's doing cocaine with her mother and an old man who's her mother's friend. And they're sitting around talking, and it's come up that she's the understudy for Peter Pan in a local small theater production of Peter Pan. And the man starts talking to her, asking her if that's why she has her hair buzzed so short. So I'll just start there. So that's why you cut your hair so short like that, just in case you end up playing Peter Pan? The old man asked. No. Amber said sternly and gave him a long, cold stare. She smashed her dead cigarette in the ashtray and waited for his response. She was daring him to say something bad about the way she looked. The way she looked was weird. She knew this, especially for the area. She was a 17-year-old girl with a shaved head. A buzz cut, leaving just a half an inch of hair, except for two strands of long black bangs in the front. She wore thick eyeliner and glistening red lipstick. She had two piercings in her face, one in her nose and one in her bottom lip. No one else around looked like her, and she was fine with that. She was a small town punk. But everyone assumed she was a lesbian because of her short haircut. She was not a lesbian. She was fairly certain of this. Over the last 2 years, she had made out with three boys and given one boy a hand job on two separate occasions, and she'd thoroughly enjoyed it. She loved watching his dick get hard and feeling like she had total control over him. She liked when he begged her to just do it a little and how his voice got high-pitched and squeaky when he asked her to please do it faster. She thought it was amazing how he squeezed her breasts right before he came, and that maybe just touching her breasts over her shirt was what actually made him come. Even though it was kind of gross, she didn't even mind it when some of it got in her hair. She liked kissing him, and doing that to him made her very hot, and she wanted him to touch her too, but she didn't ask him to touch her the first time, and he didn't try, and after she gave him a hand job the second time, and after he came, she asked him to go down on her. And he acted very weird and zipped up his pants and said, maybe next time. Then he never spoke to her again. And that made her feel like shit. It was a bumpy start to her sex life. She was having a lot of bumpy starts. The reason everyone thought she was a lesbian wasn't just because she'd kept her head shaved since she was 15, but also because a few months ago, she'd been at this house party and this other thing had happened that she deeply regretted. The house party was thrown by a senior boy on the basketball team. Half the school was there. She'd gotten drunk on whiskey and was sitting outside on a porch swing smoking. A little ways away, in the kids' backyard, there was a bonfire, and some of the boys were out there smoking and doing funnel shots of keg beer. this girl came out of the house party, an actual fucking cheerleader from her class who had never spoken to Amber. She stood next to her on the porch and asked if she had a cigarette, and Amber gave her one. And she stood there and smoked it and chatted with her. She was nice. She asked Amber who the woman on her t-shirt was, and Amber told her it was Patty Smith. The girl didn't know who that was, and Amber told her she wrote that song Gloria, you know, Jesus died for someone's sins, but not mine. She knew she seemed cool when she said this and blew perfect smoke rings in the air, and the cheerleader agreed she seemed cool too, and the cheerleader was drunk, and she looked at Amber in a way a cheerleader had never looked at her before, and she said, "You're really weird, but you're kind of cool too." And Amber felt like she was in some Lifetime movie about small towns, and the girl said, "You know, you're pretty even though you don't have any hair. You have to, like, have exceptionally strong facial structure to pull that off." Then one of the boys by the bonfire several yards away must have noticed the cheerleader because he shouted her name and whistled and waved at her to come over, and she shouted, "1 minute." Then she got a mischievous look on her face and took a big swig of her wine cooler and flicked her cigarette into the yard and turned to Amber and said, "Want a kiss?" Amber shrugged. "I guess," was all she said. Then the cheerleader flicked her blonde hair around with a toss of her head and shouted something asinine to the boys standing around the bonfire and straddled Amber on the porch swing. And then the cheerleader's tongue was in her mouth and her soft breasts were grazing Amber's chin and her soft thighs were pressed against her lap and something in her stomach shot through Amber like an electric jolt, and she really liked it. She was drunk, and she kissed the cheerleader deeply, and the boys started hooting, and the cheerleader writhed like she was fucking a long dick that wasn't there, and Amber took her by the waist and pulled her into her and began running one hand up the cheerleader's thigh till her thumb reached the girl's panties, and everything was swirling in her head as she pressed her thumb in and caressed the cheerleader's clit over her panties. And then the cheerleader squealed and pulled away and smacked Amber's arm and jumped off of her and shouted loud enough for everyone in the yard to hear, "What the fuck are you doing? I was just playing around. What are you, like an actual lesbian or something? Oh my God." The cheerleader ran her fingers through her blonde hair like she was washing something away and stormed back into the house, slamming the door behind her. The dumb boys stood next to the dumb bonfire, holding their dumb funnels in their hands, staring dumbly at her with their dumb jock eyes. She stood, picked up her solo cup of half-drunk whiskey and Sprite from where it sat at her feet, tossed it in the yard toward them, and left the party. 2 days later at school, as she walked past the cheerleader and her friends gathered in the hallway at the cheerleader's locker, the cheerleader said loudly enough for her to hear, "I thought she was going to rape me." Amber stopped walking, turned, and took 3 confident steps so that she was face to face with the cheerleader. The cheerleader's friends, who were all other cheerleaders, readied themselves for something, also looking aghast. "What did you say?" Amber asked aggressively. The pretty blonde cheerleader looked left, then right, obviously not used to being confronted and more than a little fearful. But she gathered herself, folded her arms, cocked her head, resting her hair, resetting her hair to one shoulder, and said, "You heard me, didn't you? I said you basically tried to rape me." Amber rolled her eyes, and then she said something that she knew was wrong as soon as the words had finished coming out of her mouth, but that was too late. She said, "Please, you'd be lucky to have me rape you." The cheerleaders just started squealing and screaming at her to get away from them. A brunette one grabbed the blonde one and placed her behind herself protectively. Amber chewed her lip ring and looked at her shoes and turned and walked away briskly with her head hung. "Shit, shit, shit," she thought. She repeated the words over in her head. "You'd be lucky to have me rape you? Why the fuck did you say that? That's like the worst thing you could have said. What the fuck is wrong with you?" For weeks, she replayed the scene in her mind and replaced what she'd actually said with possibly better things. "I'm sorry, I thought you wanted it. Did that seem somehow more rapey? I'm sorry, I was drunk. I was confused. Just joking. I'm sorry, I think I might be bisexual. No, that didn't make any sense. Maybe a completely different route. You thought I was going to rape you. You basically did rape me. I didn't ask you to crawl on top of me and start humping my lap. That was better, maybe, though very graphic. But this one seemed to vindicate her. Sometimes when she replayed it this way, she called the cheerleader a pervert and spit on her feet. None of this made her feel any better, though. And ever since then, most people in the school treated her like she was totally insane. The old man was staring at her short hair. She was staring at him like she was daring him to say something else about it. He didn't say anything else about it. He just nodded, accepting her simple no as an answer. No, she hadn't cut her hair short for Peter Pan. Thanks.
That was great. Thank you. What a great piece.
So much teen angst.
Yeah. Teen angst that turns into 20s angst that turns into middle-aged angst.
I guess so.
The angst don't quit.
Nope.
All right, Shavisa. Thanks so much. It was great talking to you.
And thank you for having me. And I'll keep reading Sensitive Skin.